Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear arguments for petitioners in the interest of LMI and JAI.
May it please the court, my name is Sean Casey. I'm from Houston and I represent the petitioners Luz and Ricardo Buenos in this cause of action. The smoking gun, if you will, in this particular case is the meeting that was in Attorney Chiaviglio's office. And I think Mrs. the mother of my client summed it up best when she said it felt like we were caged animals. In order to void a affidavit of relinquishment, it's necessary, and we believe it was shown at the trial court level, that there was overreaching on the part of a number of people. We further believe that in terms of the statutory requirements for placing a child, were totally violated. The respondent's reply basically, as I understand it, breaks down into two issues. One is a procedural issue in terms of waiver and in terms of things that were basically presented in his motion to dismiss the lack of jurisdiction, which this court has previously overruled. And so for that reason, I'm not going to spend a lot of time, though there's quite a bit of time I think spent on his brief and that issue, unless the court wants to address it further. So then we get into the other issue, and that is the one that, in terms of, as it applies particularly to the waiver that was presented by Luz Duenas, he says that she was the one that induced that particular, those written promises from Mr. Segura to get future pictures, to get future updates. Basically, their argument is an estoppel argument. An estoppel argument, in fact, the cases that they cite are estoppel-type arguments, saying, okay, if you put out something there, you can't then come back and say, well, since you were the one that put it out there, you can't now rely on the grounds to reverse it.
Well, let me ask you, taking your argument to its logical conclusion, wouldn't we then have to require in all these proceedings, in voluntary relinquishment cases, that a certified interpreter be there and translate every word, word for word?
I think by the very fact, I think the affidavit almost requires that, by the very fact of doing initials, that I have read it, I have understood it, I have, you know.
So, I mean, that would be what we would have to do.
I would certainly think in order
although
to,
it's not required by statute.
Well, what's required by statute, though, is that a person, you know, have knowledge of this sort of stuff.
Which is a factual determination for the trial court to make at the time everyone's before the court.
Agreed.
And the way I read your argument is, we would then take it out of that realm to determine whether it's understood or let the fact finder, being the judge in this case, find that. Or you would require that there be in other words, if I'm on the trial court and there's a procedure like this before me, I can't conduct it unless I have a certified interpreter there to word-for-word translate. I'm not saying that would be a bad thing.
No, what I'm saying is I don't know that that would be necessary in every case, but in terms of the particular case in this, I mean, to me it's very ironic that the fact that Mr. Duenas was provided an interpreter there at this particular proceeding. So obviously there had to be some cause for concern, I would think, a red flag at the minimum, that this individual was not a person who understood English as his primary language. And in fact,
well, and there was some interpretation done there. Again, you would have to require a certified interpreter to literally read every word.
Obviously that would make sure that this problem didn't arise. But I mean, in terms of to say that it must be done that way, I don't know, because I'm assuming that most people, when they're under oath, are going to be forthcoming as to whether or not they understand or don't understand, even if they may have been born in a country other than this one and English was not their primary language. But the problem we've got here is that we have a genuine dispute, but I think the evidence is overwhelming, and again, by the very fact that we've got an interpreter there at the trial on this cause, and you know what he did understand, and what he, you know, according to his testimony and testimony of others, was this threat of jail and everything else going on, that it seemed to me that the evidence was overwhelming that...
So we are weighing the evidence here. We have to find there was no evidence to support what the trial court did.
I think, in terms of this case, I think...
But what precludes someone from coming in after the fact, absent a certified court reporter, a record showing that it was literally translated? What's to stop someone after the fact from coming in and saying, I was railroaded, I really didn't understand it, I said I did, And we do have testimony that parts of it were translated accurately, just not all. What's to prevent someone from coming in after the fact and saying, well, really, I didn't?
I would hope that, I mean, first off, you know, what prevents anybody from being dishonest is what you're saying, if they said that and it wasn't true.
No, they just said, I think he would acknowledge he understood a lot. He just now says he didn't understand at all.
Well, as a matter of fact, he verified. He said that he read it, and they're all true, just personal knowledge. He did that in front of somebody. I mean, so isn't he...
You say he said that in terms of when he signed the affidavit, or
yeah. I mean, didn't you say you would hope that people wouldn't show up and then say that, you know, say that they understood, and then later on say they didn't?
What I'm trying to say is he said that.
But he did. He said it under. She was put under oath, and he said he understood it.
But when you say he said it, I mean, he didn't testify to that in court. I'm talking about after the fact. I thought that was what Justice was asking.
Maybe I misunderstood your answer. I thought you said you hoped people wouldn't say that they understand something and then later on say that they didn't.
All right. But when I'm, and maybe, because I think what Justice was asking, or at least I thought, was in terms of coming back after the fact and being deceptive about, even though actually understanding when they're writing it. What I understand you're asking is in terms of he said he did understand it, but where he says he understood it is on the very affidavit. It's in question as to whether he understood it. And in terms of the affidavit, I think he signed an initial because of the pressure that was being put on him, and I figured that was a way not to go to jail.
Mr. Casey, do you think that the fact of understanding or not, do you think that has to be established, that Mr. Duenas understood the nature of the document he was signing by clear and convincing evidence, or would it be just a preponderance of the evidence the trial court gets to decide, or what sort of standard is applicable?
In terms of because you're waiving a constitutional right, I think clear and convincing evidence would be the more appropriate standard.
And under that standard, if there is some evidence that he understood some words in English, would that satisfy a clear and convincing standard that he understood what was going on?
And again, Judge, I don't think it's just merely to say that I understand it. I think where it says that I've read every word, I mean, to me, I think somebody has to, I don't think some is appropriate. Because then where you got that initial that says, you know, I've read every word, I understand every, and so, I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that some of those people at least attempted and maybe succeeded at sort of giving him a general idea, if you will, an overview. But I don't think that's adequate because you've got, I mean, that's why the statute requires or those affidavits have all those initials in each line so that there's no doubt that they have understood each and every word that's going down on there. So in terms of saying that they understand some of it, I don't think that's good enough. I think they got to understand every word, and that's why you have those specific. That's why it's bolded. That's why it's...
But now there is testimony from others who are present that he understood what he was signing.
That's correct.
And why isn't that enough for us to affirm the trial court's determination on a fact finding?
Well, I think in terms of, I mean, part of the problem is if you're talking about subjective. If I'd been a trial attorney, I'd be going to object and not cause some speculation as to, you know, what somebody else understands or doesn't understand. And so in terms of that type of evidence, you know, I just don't even know how probative that should be. It would seem to me that, I mean, I kept waiting for somebody to testify and saying, have you ever seen him have a conversation at home in English? I mean, that question, to my knowledge, was never asked. You know, have you ever seen him conduct a business at a store? Those are the sort of things that I would have thought that might have given some evidence credibility. But instead, everybody focused on that particular meeting and saying, well, you know, did he understand what was going on? You know, I think that would be...
Ms. Casey, what do you understand the legal effect when you introduce an affidavit? What is the petitioner approved at that time?
Well, I mean, I'm assuming that because the affidavit came in without objection, so I mean, in terms of the code that you have at least prima facie established that which is necessary under the code to provide for a termination, and in terms of whether there's some objection to it, and again, I think that's what the purpose of this trial was, because my clients felt that they had been overreached.
Do you believe, or am I hearing you right, that if there were no objection, then a prima facie case would have been made, and then the burden then would have shifted to the other side to somehow or another impeach that or raise it.
When you say that side, you mean my side of this case.
Well, stand up if that's your side.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's correct, sir.
Yeah. So the burden, in effect, the prima facie burden of clear and convincing evidence even is already established once you introduce the affidavit, and then it's from there on it's the other side, your side, duty now to come forward and to discredit that and prove, to make your case, to shift the burden back.
And I disagree with one thing, because I think it shifts back, because I think once my clients, I mean, in terms of what they come up and say, look, we don't understand, or I don't understand, or my client doesn't understand, I think at that point in time, I think the burden shifts back again to the person trying to establish the validity of the affidavit.
Well, at what point in time, a year later, 2 years later, at what point in time does it shift back? A year later, 2 years later, when they decide?
I'm talking about just in terms of, I'm an old divorce lawyer, and I think of it in terms of the community property stuff, where you start with a presumption of one way, and then somebody puts on something that says that it's separate, and then it's back to the other person to establish the community. So I'm talking about right there at the trial.
And at the trial, you've got the affidavit, which is a prima facie case.
Prima facie case. And so the respondents in this case, at this level, and met that prima facie case. And then at that point in time, when Mr. Duane says, look, here's the overreaching problems that I had, here's the language barrier that I had, here are the various things that I was dealing with, then at that point in time, I think the burden shifts and sits there and says, no, there wasn't this overreaching. This was all done, and this affidavit is not just merely a piece of paper, if you will. This was something that was done correctly and within the...
But that was not done at the hearing.
I don't think they met that burden, if that's what you're asking. When you say it's not what was done, what was done from our standpoint or their standpoint of reading.
Well, nothing occurred at the hearing from your client to indicate that at that time he didn't understand.
Well, I think he did. I mean, he sat there and talked about that, English was not his language. He just got jailed. He was just told to sign this stuff. He said that he didn't understand it.
I'm talking about at the relinquishment hearing.
That's what I'm talking about. I mean, he testified about that, as I recall, that he didn't fully understand. And I will tell you that these are not the most artful questions that were asked. I mean, there's a lot of...
Well, what do we do with the testimony from the attorney, Chivaglia, who says that he told him that he would fully, finally, and forever give up any parental rights to his children and his right to change his mind, and that he was speaking English, but that the mother translated it in Spanish, and the third person who understood Spanish confirmed that was adequately conveyed?
My feeling is on that, again, is what I'd answered previously. I don't think you can do a summary, if you will, or, hit the high points even. I think it's necessary just by the wording of the statute, the wording of the affidavits. I mean, that's why you have those specific forms such as that, because just in terms of when some third party is sitting there telling you this is what it is, and that's why that evidence document speaks, best for itself. And I just don't think
so. What in this circumstance, what in this case, but we've got an affidavit where he says he read the thing, he read it all the way, he's got it initialed on deal that says he understood, he verifies, he gets sworn in and swears that it's all true and correct. What is the rule you now propose when the person who signed it now comes forward and says they didn't understand it? What is the rule you propose that would establish clear and convincingly that they understood?
I basically think the rule is already there. I mean, in terms of what we got, in terms of what is overreaching and what is not, and what I believe is that in terms of the language barrier is overreaching. I'm not asking for
ordinarily overreaching it. Don't take this as gospel. I may be wrong, but it seems to me under these circumstances you'd have to prove that the pressure was so great that you could not exercise your own volition. It's sort of like that undue influence. So you'd have to say that I was forced, maybe because he says they threatened me with jail, I signed it or something. But
that's one type of overreach. But I think there's another type of overreach too, is if you negotiate a deal with somebody that has no ability to communicate with you. And that, to me, frankly, I thought that's probably why this court was attracted to take this case, because it wasn't you know, the jail thing to me is secondary.
And, it is because he claims he did not understand English.
And you got somebody sign off on his affidavit saying I understand every word. And
so your standard would be, if he says he doesn't understand English, that what you must do is read verbatim the words in the language that he claims he understands.
I think if they had had that, and again, the ultimate or best example would be having a certified interpreter sitting there going, "Work just to read. This is what the document. You understand it? Yes. You know, initial. Yes." As opposed to his wife of a few days, because it's very hot, saying here, sign here, sign here, telling her mother to shut up. I just don't think it passed the smell test even close.
So, I'm sorry.
Just here we are 3 years later, and we're going to answer the question: what is the standard in this case? Do we have to show, as a matter of law, he did not understand? Is that what you're saying, that we? Are you going to take on that burden?
And again, because of the subjectivity, I don't know if you can say showing somebody as a matter of law. I mean, to me, a matter of law is something where you see it black and white. I mean, there's no question it's a problem here in terms of what does this man understand? Because, you know, he's actually the only one that could say it for sure, but there was no evidence. And the only evidence was, you know, if you ever talk to him in English, and his wife said, well, I taught him the word seagull.
Well, but there's other evidence, too. I mean, he worked at a restaurant, and there was testimony that he understood a lot of what was going on there. I mean,
my understanding
he responded in English to the judge.
I understand he responded in English to the judge after he got the translated the question. I mean, he would say yes or no, but I'm not so sure because they have a translator on there. I don't know what. I couldn't tell. I just assumed
that. Well, there's indication that he knew other than the word seagull.
Well, no question about it, but we're talking about a legal document. We're not talking about preparing the restaurant food, which he testified to, is that somebody else would sit there and tell him that, would even translate that for him.
I have a procedural question.
Sure.
Setting aside your undue influence argument in your brief, is the only point you've gotten from us the due process argument, or are you also making a statutory argument that it doesn't comply with the statute?
As it relates to him, I've not made that. As it relates to her,
you've not made what? I'm sorry. You've not, as it relates to him, you've not made what?
I don't believe I've made any statutory argument.
Your only argument is due process.
That's all I have to bring to this court.
Was that raised in the trial court?
Interesting. The respondent in the brief says that I, in the oral argument, acknowledged that it had not been raised. And that's not, I think, an optional completeness. Who it was is that I was asked whether or not they raised it, and I said, well, at the trial court level, nobody used the magic words due process, but it was obviously very clear that all along that these were the complaints they were having about the lack of ability to understand and the duress factor in terms of the jail. So I mean, there's no question that evidentiary that was all there, but nobody said, no, I'm raising a due process.
What about in the court of appeals?
The court of appeals, it was right. I mean,
in what point?
Again, I mean, I think it was at the beginning, because even in the Court of Appeals opinion, I believe they said they talked about, I'm sorry, I don't know what they're talking about. I'm pretty sure it was raised.
I think they argued it wasn't raised for rehearing, that's why I was asking.
I'm sorry?
I thought they had argued it wasn't raised for rehearing, and that's why I was asking.
Well, I think what wasn't raised for rehearing was the statute, in terms of citing that statute in terms of occurring the violation. I mean, I think due process was raised. I see it right at the very beginning at the appellate level.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Otto Hewitt,
May it please the court, my name is Otto Hewitt from Alvin, Texas, and I'm here representing the respondents today, the Montague family, who actually joins us in court. I'm prepared to respond to the court's questions and also to present some argument. What I'd like to do is, first of all, deal with the undue influence fraud issue, and then deal with the preservation the preservation argument that Justice Owen just touched on. I also think that it is obvious, I think, to this court that insofar as, I'll call him Ricardo, that's his name, the natural father, insofar as whether he understood English or not, I concur that that was a fact question. It involved credibility choices that the fact finder got to make. The fact finder got to weigh his testimony and got to weigh the testimony of others who testified that, yes, he did speak English, yes, he did understand. In fact, the record shows that he spoke English before the ceremony, during the ceremony, and even after the ceremony.
What was the English that he spoke from the record?
The record shows that, first of all, he was... I won't put this in chronological order. I'll tell the court what I remember. He was asked about the spelling of his name and shown the document. He responded in English that his name was correctly spelled. There is a case right on point that we cited to the court in our brief that even calls points that out, where the person later complaining years after the fact that, gee, I know what I said in the affidavit, but I really didn't understand, that they took the time to read it and understand it enough and knew enough about it to even
okay, so he can spell his name.
He can spell his name. He understood the question that was put to him in the English side of the attorney.
Which question?
Is your name spelled correctly in this document? The record shows that the attorney repeatedly asked him, do you understand this? Do you understand that this document is, or this line is saying? And that he responded affirmatively in English. The record also shows...
Where does the record show that?
Where?
How can you tell what's being translated and what he's saying?
Well, he was responding to the attorney.
Yeah, but there was a translator.
I'm not talking about the trial now, Judge. I'm talking about the affidavit signing ceremony. Correct. It was being translated.
Well, you're not talking about the trial.
No, sir. I'm talking about the ceremony.
The record I've got, the person named Esther, and she says, and he answered English, and she says, well, he didn't speak much. He just nodded his head. I don't recall him speaking much at all. Is that right or not?
I think that's partly right, but there's other testimony. The attorney Chevalier said that there was some specific testimony that he was offering in front of the fact finder that he asked Ricardo a particular question, and Ricardo answered yes, answered in the affirmative. The Court of Appeals opinion reflects that.
And further, wasn't there also someone there who overheard the translation, who understood English, I mean Spanish, and said that that was an accurate translation?
Yes. There were actually two Spanish-speaking witnesses other than, I'll call them the parties, who were there, and they testified, and I've forgotten their names, Mrs. Tribaldo and I think Mrs. Garcia. They testified that Ricardo was being told the correct things in Spanish as the attorney was reading from the affidavit in English.
I thought the record was the grandmother gave him like a paragraph-long summary of what the affidavit said, and it was undisputed that no one translated the affidavit word for word or even paragraph by paragraph to him in Spanish.
There's a conflict in the record to that effect because it was either Mrs. Tribaldo or Mrs. Garcia, as I recall, that said, testified that Ricardo was being told the correct things in English, the correct things in Spanish, as the attorney was reading the document in English.
But now, the testimony is unequivocal that the whole thing took less than a minute. So how could you read that? You could read the affidavit in English in a minute.
I don't think it took a
minute.
That's
what the lawyer said.
I think it took longer than that. I also think that and responding to your question, Judge.
Well, Esther said, here's the testimony. And are you sitting here and telling the court today when the attorneys and the secretary presented, attorney and secretary presented the 7-page document to Mr. Duenas, that those 7 pages were translated from Mr. Duenas in Spanish. And Esther says each page was not translated word for word, no.
I think that's correct. She certainly said that. But Mrs. Tribaldo also said that what was being spoken to him in Spanish was the correct things as the lawyer was speaking in English.
Well, let's assume that, just assume with me that the record shows that the entire affidavit was not translated from beginning to end, that there were entire sections that were left out.
Mm-hmm.
What is the evidence that Mr. Duenas understood, for example, there are statutory requirements that have to be given if you're before termination is permitted, but there's no evidence that those portions were translated to Mr. Duenas. So assume with me that the entire affidavit was not translated. So what's the evidence that he understood what he was signing? And if you'll add into that, you told me, I think, 2 instances, and I think the record actually said yet, that he used that word. What other evidence is there that he either spoke or understood English?
There are there is evidence that he had that he spoke English at work. There was evidence after the signing ceremony, immediately after the signing ceremony, where Esther, Maria's sister, went up to him and congratulated him for his courage and what a wise decision he had made and so forth, and asked Maria's mom to translate that into Spanish, and Ricardo answered Esther that he understood her and that translation was not necessary.
Well, let me just suggest that, I mean, there are lawyers out here in this room. We understand res judicata. I mean, we understand several Latin phrases, but no one would accuse me of understanding Latin generally. And so if there are a couple instances in which Duenas did understand the word courage and maybe knew how to spell his name in English, is that really enough, if the standard is clear and convincing, that he knew what he was signing?
Yes, and I think that there's more in the record than just those items that you mentioned. For example, the record says that he was being told, that he was told, quote, he was giving up his rights as a father. He was told he wasn't going to be the father anymore. He was told he was giving up his rights. He was told he's giving up his rights to his children. He was told he'll no longer be responsible for them once this is all through. That's it.
Was he told that he could no longer direct the moral and religious training of the children, or that he would lose power to consent to his children's marriage, or to enlist in the armed forces, or to submit to psychiatric or surgical treatment, or to make substantial legal significance, decisions of substantial legal significance concerning the children? All those things, were those translated to him? Is there evidence of that?
Here's what I can tell you, Doug. I can tell you that, and frankly, I don't recall those items that you mentioned being in the record, but I can tell you this, that there is nothing in the record that says he was not told. There was testimony repeatedly from a number of non-party witnesses that he understood, non-party witnesses to the affidavit signing, that he understood. He, as Judge asked the question just a few minutes ago, what's the impact of him sponsoring the affidavit, his own affidavit, into evidence? Well, I can tell you what the impact of that is, and it's seen in Cactus Drilling, among other cases, and the impact of him sponsoring that affidavit, his own affidavit, into evidence is that he was bound by the facts recited therein. And the facts recited therein are exactly what you just finished saying, plus a whole bunch more. So there's evidence that he spoke English and understood English from non-party witnesses at the signing ceremony. There is evidence that the material was translated correctly for him. There's divergence from that. There's not a whole bunch of detail. I certainly would like to see a lot more detail, but I was not the trial lawyer, just like Mr. Casey was not the trial lawyer for his sign. I would certainly like to see a lot more detail, but we're talking about credibility issues here, weight of evidence issues here that are determinations solely in the purview of the fact finder.
Let me ask you a little bit about legal standards here. I'm a little bit confused on this. This is not a parental termination case.
Yes, it was. It's not an adoption case, though.
Well, it's a voluntary relinquishment.
Yes, that's right.
Which is different from parental termination.
Yes, you're correct.
Because parental termination is involuntary.
Okay.
And therefore, you must have clear and convincing evidence.
Mm-hmm.
Are we certain clear and convincing applies in a voluntary relinquishment case? And if so, how is it applied?
Okay. Here's what went on at trial. Ricardo and Maria.
Well, I'm just trying to understand, if we're going to state the legal concept, mm-hmm. is the legal concept in a voluntary relinquishment case, there must be clear and convincing evidence of voluntariness,
mm-hmm.
or it must be clear and convincing evidence that the affidavit was verbatim translated? I'm trying to get understand what the actual... Because
okay.
we seem to be parroting this clear and convincing standard that applies in an involuntary termination, mm-hmm. and I don't know what that standard looks like when it is a voluntary termination.
Here's what I think, and I think the record bears this out as well. I think there are shifting burdens here, and the argument that we've been making today, the argument we've been talking about today, involve things that were affirmative defenses that were Mr. Casey's client's duty to plead and prove, and they had to do that, and they acknowledged this at trial. It's on the record. The trial counsel said, we have to prove this by preponderance of the evidence.
Prove voluntariness by preponderance mm-hmm. of the evidence?
We have to prove voluntariness. We have to prove undue influence. We have to prove overreaching. All of these things that we have to prove, that's the petitioners here, had to prove at trial, and they acknowledge that.
So it's their burden at trial to overcome the affidavit by preponderance of the evidence?
Yes. The case law is... legion, longer than I am tall, and certainly more than the hair on my head, that when a voluntary affidavit of relinquishment is tendered into evidence in due form, and there's not any complaint that it was not in due form, that alone, and counsel has admitted this in briefs in front of the Court of Appeals and in briefs here, typically citing the N. Ray Bruno case, that alone is enough to establish termination.
So a signature in this context, you're saying, is all that is required to establish voluntariness, even as against a claim that the person who signed it had no idea. Let's say that the person was deaf, dumb, and blind, and just had no idea what was on there, but someone directed the hand to the line and, mm-hmm. and the signature was made, that is enough.
It is enough.
You're saying that's enough to shift the burden to them to show.
Then the burden shifts for the person to come in and say, I was blind.
And then once the burden shifts and that presumption is rebutted by testimony that I'm deaf, dumb, and blind,
mm-hmm.
then does the burden shift back to the proponent of the affidavit
or
not?
I think the determination of whether it was rebutted or not is a determination made by the fact finder.
Well, let's assume that, I mean, just all I'm talking about is evidence. I mean,
mm-hmm.
just raising evidence contrary to the presumption.
Okay.
So the person comes in and says, I can't see, I can't hear, I can't speak. And there's no evidence to the contrary. Does that shift the burden back to the proponent of the affidavit?
I don't think so. I don't think it shifts like that. I think the burden is on me to come in and show the requisites for voluntary relinquishment.
Yes,
and
we
did
clear
that.
And convincing evidence
yes.
that it was voluntary.
Yes.
That's your burden.
Yes, and we did that in a variety of ways.
Wait, let me make sure I understand, because I'm confused here.
Okay.
Affidavit comes in.
Okay.
Prima facie proof.
Yes.
Burden shifts.
Yes.
They have to prove not voluntary by preponderance.
Yes.
If that burden's met, then it shifts to the other side to prove clear and convincing?
No. I think the initial burden is on the person. The initial burden is on us.
Okay. But you're saying the affidavit satisfies that burden?
Alone satisfies that. Then the burden shifted to them.
So at that point, we don't get into clear and convincing anything.
Right.
Okay.
Then the burden shifted to Ricardo and Maria to establish their affirmative defenses. I was blind. I can't understand English. I didn't understand what I was signing.
As a matter of law.
A gun was put to my head for me to sign. The burden shifted to them to establish those affirmative defenses by preponderance of the evidence, and that's a fact finder, credibility, weight of evidence choice. If they had done that, then they would have established an affirmative defense to the voluntariness of those affidavits, and it would have been toast. They did not establish those affirmative defenses.
And our review of that decision is there was no evidence to support the trial court's failure to find, or we have to show that they established their case as a matter of law.
As a matter of law.
Okay.
And that leads me to the next issue that I want to present real briefly. Respond to basically that question and Justice Owen's earlier question, and that is this preservation of issue argument. The matter of law questions before this court today, and they're all matter of law questions that petitioners have presented to this court. Those issues were never raised at the trial court. Never. Counsel hasn't pointed you to one place in the record where it was. There was no motion for new trial raising anything because there was no motion for new trial. The case was pitched in the Court of Appeals as factual sufficiency. And I can point the court to several places in the brief. The appellant's brief in the Court of Appeals, page 12, he wanted a remand. Factual sufficiency relief. He said the preponderance of the evidence is factual sufficiency. He talked
about... Was the argument raised in the briefs that he did not understand English and the affidavit therefore was not voluntary? Was the argument raised in the CA briefs that he didn't understand English and therefore the affidavit was not voluntary?
Yes, that was raised, but it was raised in the context of a factual sufficiency question. The first time that matter of law issues appeared in this case was on motion for rehearing after the Court of Appeals already issued its decision. Matter of law appeared for the first time in this case, not in the trial court, not on the issues, not in the Court of Appeals briefs, but on motion for rehearing in the Court of Appeals. And that tells me under Sherry and Dreyer and Steve Sash, a number of other cases by this court, that these matter of law issues are not properly before this court for review. You just can't switch horses in midstream like that without even giving the trial court a shot at it.
Questions? Thank you, Governor.
Thank you very much.
May it please the court, I want to reaffirm what Justice Jefferson asked about in terms of what was said and what wasn't said as the specifics that are contained in the affidavit. I would direct the court's attention to the record in volume 3, and starting on page 45 when they are testifying as Mr. Chevaglia, and he specifically asked who was doing any translating, and it talks about that it was Maria's mother that was doing some translating. And it just says, Ms. Pruitt, and what would that would be Maria's mother, that's correct. And what do you recall her doing with regards to that document? Well, there's a specific part of the form that requires a set of initials by each one. It's a double space section, and it denotes, if I'm paraphrasing, it says they understand the importance of this document. Here you go, and then it says, tell me what happened, if you would, what happened? I directed his attention specifically to this section and began to read it. And at that point, Esther said, Mom, why don't you translate that to him to make sure he understands?
At that point, Maria turned to her mother in a very agitated fashion and said, "He don't give a shit. He don't even buy diapers." So nonetheless, Ms. Pruitt did continue to, what sounded to me was to translate that in Spanish. Did it take her a while to read that into Spanish? She didn't seem to read it. She, Ms. Pruitt, the grandmother, and she, I'm sorry, I skipped that here, didn't seem to read it.
Let me just go back for a minute. Do you agree that at the hearing, the affidavit is the proof, and then it shifts to your clients to do a preponderance of the evidence regarding undue influence, involuntariness, etc.?
Yes.
You agree with that analysis?
Yes.
All right. And at that point, isn't it an intensely factual inquiry? Don't we have to find as a matter of law there was no evidence that he understood English?
Well, no, I think it's not just a matter of understanding. It's a matter of what of.
I think you're saying the signature is not prima facie proof. I mean, as I understood the argument, for somebody who claims that they don't even speak the language
right.
in which the affidavit
right.
is written.
So, I mean, it's not just a matter. I mean, in terms of, again, I think they've got to show that I mean, when they're sitting talking about the terms of translation, and they're saying to translate, and they didn't.
Let me go ahead. You agree that to set aside the affidavit, you had a burden of preponderance to show that that affidavit was not voluntary.
Yes.
The trial court ruled against you.
Correct.
So on appeal, your burden is to prove that, at least in this court,
correct.
And apparently at some point in the court of appeals, to win, you have to say that you established the non-voluntariness as a matter of law. If you lost on the factual decision by the trial court, then your burden is not to convince them there's a fact question. Your burden is to convince them that there was not a fact question, that as a matter of law you established he didn't understand it. And the basis of your assertion that as a matter of law he did not understand it is because he did not speak English. Right?
That's correct.
And therefore, the law required it to be read to him verbatim in Spanish.
That's okay.
If the court doesn't agree that the affidavit has to be read verbatim, in any event, do you lose based on the fact that the gist of the affidavit, at least arguably in the evidence, was given to him in Spanish?
Probably.
But let me ask you this. Couldn't the affidavit be voluntary as to what was translated only and not as to what was not translated? For example, this affidavit, there's a summary that says you lose the rights to your children. Do most people understand what that means, that you might never be able to see that your children again, or that you might not be able to consent to marriage or to write to them or to telephone them?
Exactly.
And there's no evidence in this record that any of those portions were translated before he signed this document.
And again, if, looking on, and I don't want to bore the court by reading, but if you look there at page 47, 48, the attorney says, I did a summary and that's all she did. And in terms of, I mean, his summary, he said, yeah, that's about what I said. And it was like three sentences. And again, such as you indicated, it's this sort of broad sweeping, you're no longer that. Whatever that might mean. And I don't think that would be adequate to me say to accept that I've got legal training.
You don't think that's the gist? If that's left out, that's not the gist? Or I'm not following?
Well, what Justice Jefferson said a moment ago is he said, well, you know, can you waive, you know, to part of that, like, such as the stuff that, you know, if you got part of it. And then I think we get back to the fact that we've attacked the affidavit as a matter of law and that it was defective because it wasn't in its entirety, because the statute has certain prerequisites that have to be in there. So I don't think you can do a partial understanding and thereby jump to termination. So, I mean, to me, that would be another ground just showing that as a matter of law that he doesn't do it because of the fact that it was only partial.
But in terms of the burden shifting, the affidavit, the signature shows the length. Your client's then burden to prove not voluntary. So your client's burden to prove, I didn't understand I was giving up the right to consent to marriage. I didn't understand I was giving up the right to do this or that. I didn't understand I was giving up the right to make these decisions, right?
I think that's correct.
But if I may follow up on that, I think it was met by the very fact that they were sitting there saying, translate. I mean, there the people that were on the other side that were encouraged to do this said, we got to translate. But then what they translated was not the statutory requirement.
Let me ask on that. Let's say that the affidavit that was given to an English-speaking person had some of the same attributes this one did, but lacked the statutorily required portion. And that signature was given. Would that be a valid affidavit, or would it not?
Absolutely not. And quite frankly, I think at that point in time, they would not have met their prima facie burden by putting in a defective affidavit in the first place. And so that's, I guess, in one sense, that's why I say it shifts back again to them. That's why I think that burden shifts, because they have shown by their own testimony of their people that they asked for translation, and the translation that they made was, again, paraphrasing. It was not statutory prerequisite.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the third argument. The court will take another brief recess.